Hey, Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling a book that really shook things up back in 1990. It felt, I don't know, less like just philosophy and more like, well, like a bomb, maybe?
You could say that. We're diving into Judith Butler's huge work, Gender Trouble, Feminism, and the Subversion of Identity.
And it's dense, for sure. But the core idea, it just changed everything, didn't it? How we talk about culture, politics, identity.
Absolutely. It's not just about identity. It's a really radical challenge to, well, the basic ways we categorize ourselves.
Yeah.
Especially that big category, woman.
Yeah, and that's our mission today, right? We want to, you know, cut through some of the academic language and really get to the heart of Butler's big thesis. Gender is a performance, not an essence.
What does that actually mean, though? And what are the political stakes? That's the key.
Exactly. If woman isn't this fixed universal thing, how can feminism even organize? How do you build a politics on something fluid, not fixed?
Good questions. And to start answering them, we should probably look at the author herself, Judith Butler, American philosopher, gender theorist.
Hugely influential. Political theory, ethics, queer studies. They hold the Maxine Elliott a professorship at UC Berkeley.
Right. But what makes their approach so different? Why does this book land the way it did?
Well, they didn't just, like, join the conversation. They brought a whole new toolkit, didn't they? Post-structuralist thinkers. People like Foucault, Derrida.
Freud, Lacan, too.
Yeah.
Heavy hitters. And using those tools allowed Butler to do something pretty unique.
How so?
Well, think about feminism before Gender Trouble. A lot of it worked with this distinction. Biological sex, the body, and then socially constructed gender, the roles, the expectations.
Okay, yeah, sex is nature, gender is nurture, sort of.
Kind of. But Butler came along and said, hold on, even our idea of sex as this raw, natural, pre-cultural fact, that itself is a cultural and political construction.
Wow, okay, so they're not just asking who fits in the box.
No, they're analyzing the grammar, the logic, the power that makes the box in the first place.
Okay, let's really unpack that big idea then. The one everyone sort of knows, even vaguely. Gender is performativity.
Right. What does Butler actually mean by that? It's not a stable thing we have.
But something we continually do, a compelled performance.
Exactly. And the key thing is this reversal. We usually think, okay, there's an inner me, man, woman, whatever, and that causes me to act in certain gendered ways.
My identity causes my actions. Seems straightforward.
Butler flips it. They argue that gender is actually created through a whole series of stylized, repetitive acts. Gestures, ways of speaking, ways of moving.
Things society kind of pushes on us.
Compels, yeah. And it's the constant repetition of these acts, these norms, that creates the illusion of a solid, internal, natural gender identity.
Whoa. Okay, wait. So the identity is the result of the actions, not the cause.
Precisely. We don't perform because we are a certain gender. We become that gender, in a sense, because we're constantly performing these acts.
That really pulls the rug out from under the idea of a fixed self, doesn't it?
It does. And think about the political side of that. If your politics, like some kinds of feminism, rely on defining a single unified group women, what happens?
You have to draw a line somewhere.
And the moment you draw that line, you create exclusions, you impose a norm, and who gets left out? Often as women of color or trans women or working class women. Anyone who doesn't fit that maybe unspoken default.
The default often being like white, middle class, straight.
Often, yes. And that leads us to another key Butler concept. The mechanism that enforces these norms, they call it the heterosexual matrix.
The matrix sounds intense. What is it?
It's this invisible cultural grid, basically. A framework that insists on a very specific alignment.
Alignment of what?
Biological sex is supposed to line up perfectly with gender identity, and that identity is supposed to dictate heterosexual desire. Sex aligns with gender, aligns with desire.
Male man desires woman. Female man desires man. That neat package.
Exactly. And according to this matrix, any other combination, anything that deviates, is rendered, well, unintelligible or unnatural, problematic.
That's where the trouble in the title comes in, I guess. Okay, let's follow the argument through the book itself. Chapter one starts with that problem of the subject, right? Who counts as women?
Yes. Butler points out the political danger. Try to define women universally, and you inevitably end up centering a particular kind of woman, usually a privileged one, and pushing others to the margins.
You create a hierarchy within the movement you're trying to build.
Right. But then they go deeper, as we mentioned. They question the stability of sex itself.
Okay, I still need to wrap my head around that. How can biological sex not be just biological?
The argument is subtle. It's not denying biology exists. It's saying we can never perceive a pure, unmediated biological body. Our perception is always already filtered through culture.
Through gender.
Through gender, yes. Mm-hmm. The language we use, the medical categories, the binary system itself, male, female, these are cultural tools. They shape how we even see and understand bodies. So the body's always already inscribed by culture, by power.
Okay, that's a huge idea. It makes sense that the next step in chapter 2 is about how these norms get enforced. How does society compel this heterosexual matrix? You mentioned psychoanalysis.
Right, this is where it gets quite theoretical, drawing on Freud and Lacan. Butler looks at how identity is formed partly through prohibition.
Things society says no to.
Exactly, like the incest taboo, for instance.
Yeah.
These rules regulate sexuality, channel it, and effectively mandate heterosexuality as the standard, the default pathway.
We learn who we're supposed to be by learning who we're not supposed to be or desire.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But then there's this other crucial, maybe trickier concept, melancholy.
Melancholy. Like sadness.
Not quite sadness in the everyday sense. Butler uses it in a specific psychoanalytic way. The idea is to form a stable identity that fits the norm. To confidently say, I am a man or I am a woman within that matrix, you often have to reject or push away other possibilities.
Other desires, other ways of being.
Yes. Maybe same-sex desires, maybe gender expressions that don't fit the mold. These possibilities have to be, in a sense, disavowed, given up.
And they don't just vanish.
According to this theory, no. They become this sort of invisible foundation of loss, of rejected possibilities that underpins the stable identity. That's the melancholy.
Wow. So every normal identity is kind of haunted by what it had to exclude.
That's the implication. The heterosexual matrix isn't just enforced by external rules. It's maintained internally, psychologically, by managing these disavowed attachments and possibilities.
That makes the whole performance idea feel much less like a voluntary choice, much heavier.
Absolutely. And that brings us right to the key distinction Butler makes in Chapter 3, performance versus performativity.
Right. Because when people hear gender as a performance, they often think of, like, an actor choosing a role, conscious choice, putting on a costume.
But Butler's performativity is different. It's generally not a conscious choice like an actor makes. It's more like a compelled, ritualized repetition of norms.
Compelled how?
Think of legal language, what Butler calls a citational practice. When a judge cites a legal precedent, they're repeating established language, established norms. They didn't invent it. They're compelled to cite it to make a valid legal statement.
Okay.
Butler argues we're doing something similar with gender. We're constantly citing or repeating these social scripts for man and woman that we didn't write. Our bodies are disciplined by this power. The repetition produces the sense of an internal identity over time.
So we're quoting scripts we didn't write. If that's the case, then the way out, the political resistance, must be what? To quote them differently, to mess up the script.
Exactly. That's the potential for subversion. Since gender is this citational practice, quoting existing norms, it can be cited differently, misquoted even.
And this is where drag comes in, right? That's the famous example.
Yes. Butler analyzes drag as subversive precisely because it exposes the constructed imitative nature of all gender.
But wait, if drag is imitating woman, doesn't that suggest there's a real woman underneath it all that's being copied?
Oh, that's the brilliant twist.
Ugh.
Butler argues drag isn't imitating a real woman, but imitating the idea of woman, the collection of signs, gestures, and stereotypes society constructs.
So it's imitating an imitation.
Exactly. It reveals that normative gender, the real man or real woman, is itself an imitation, a stylized performance trying to approximate an ideal that has no original essence behind it. Drag exposes the artificiality of the norm.
It troubles the distinction between the original and the copy by showing the original was already a copy. Wow. Right. Okay. That's a lot to take in. Let's try to boil down some key themes for someone listening.
Okay. Theme one has to be the deconstruction of the sex gender binary, the core idea. The body isn't purely natural before culture gets to it.
Right. And the reflection there is huge. It dismantles arguments that gender roles are okay because they're just natural or based on biology. That foundation gets shaky.
Definitely. Then theme two, the compulsory nature of heterosexuality or the heterosexual matrix.
Just naming that grid, that sex, gender, desire alignment. It lets you see the system, right? See the rules that police everyone, even those who fit in.
Absolutely. Then the central mechanism, theme three, gender as performativity, the doing creates the being.
And the takeaway there is, if we recognize we're constantly doing gender, maybe we can see little moments, everyday chances to do it slightly differently. Small shifts.
Small shifts, yes. Which leads to theme four, the politics of parity and coalition. Liberation isn't necessarily about finding one perfect definition of woman.
It's more about troubling the norms, using parody, like drag, to expose the construction.
Yes, and building political movements, coalitions, based on shared goals. Not on forcing everyone into one identical identity category. It allows for difference within the movement.
Yeah. That seems much more inclusive, potentially. Okay, let's talk about some specific lines. Butler's writing is famously dense, but some phrases really cut through.
Agreed. How about this one, capturing the core mechanism? Gender is the repeated stylization of the body that congeal over time to produce the appearance of substance, of a natural sort of being.
Congeal over time. I like that. It emphasizes the repetition, the way these acts harden into what looks like a solid, natural core. It's an illusion built slowly.
Right. And here's maybe the most direct statement of performativity. There is no gender identity behind the expressions of gender. That identity is performatively constituted by the very expressions that are said to be its result.
That just nails the reversal. The identity is the expressions, performatively created, not the other way around. We really do have cause and effect backwards in our usual thinking.
Totally. And one more, pointing towards the political project. The critical task for feminism is not to establish a single foundation, but to interrogate the very production of the category of women and of men.
So don't just define the group, analyze the power that creates the group categories in the first place. That's a fundamental shift in focus.
It is. So how does all this very philosophical thinking actually cash out? What are the real life applications?
Well, first, I think personal understanding and self-acceptance. For anyone who feels like they don't fit neatly into the boxes, gender non-conforming people, non-binary folks, trans people.
This theory offers a kind of validation, doesn't it? It says your fluid identity isn't less real. All gender identities are constructed performances. It legitimizes playing with expression.
Exactly. And then there's workplace and institutional change. If gender norms are upheld by repeated practices,
then you can change the practices. You can implement policies for chosen pronouns, create inclusive restrooms, challenge the unconscious biases that reinforce the binary in meetings and hiring.
It becomes about changing the everyday script, the things we're compelled to repeat at work.
Makes sense. And what about, say, parenting and education?
Huge implications there. It encourages parents and educators to offer kids way more diverse models of how to be a person, you know, moving beyond the pink and blue aisles.
And advocating for schools to be more inclusive.
Yeah.
Challenging gendered assumptions in the curriculum or on the playground.
Absolutely. Things like gender-neutral bathrooms aren't just symbolic. They reflect this understanding that the performance is learned early, and we can offer kids a wider repertoire from the start.
So looking back at the whole book, what's the biggest takeaway for you? What stands out?
For me, it's that realization that the things we feel are most deeply us, most natural, like our gender, are actually shaped by these huge, often invisible social forces. It's kind of unsettling.
Destabilizing, for sure, but also potentially liberating.
Yeah, liberating. Because if it's constructed, it means it's not fixed in stone. It can be reconstructed differently. What about you?
I think the most valuable piece is realizing the power dynamics embedded in the repetition itself. The insight isn't just that we repeat norms, but how the repetition works and how it can be subtly altered.
So the final thought for you, the listener, might be this. The challenge isn't if we repeat gender norms, because Butler suggests we're kind of compelled to repeat something, but how we repeat them.
Can we use that repetition, that citation, to open up new possibilities, to make identity less regulated, more fluid? The resistance might just be in those small, everyday acts of doing gender slightly askew.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world.
This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.